Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 279 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. Let's get this show on the road.
All right. Well, go over and press like and subscribe and notify, 5-star reviews, all that fun stuff. Hey, where'd my little, I pressed the button to do the thing and it's supposed to do the thing. There it goes. Okay. Now you know to press like and subscribe and share it and such and such. Of course, go to your favorite podcast app and subscribe, and then you'll get a download right when it gets released. It's fantastic. You don't even have to work for it. What are we doing this weekend?
Well, it's a holiday weekend, so we're going to be taking it easy.
I did say, look, come on, man. I'm looking at how long it is, and you said we're going to, quote-unquote, take it easy. You said we were going to take it easy last week, and it was 55 minutes. That is not what my definition of easy is.
Well, that's because you need to stop blabbing so much.
My fault. I see. Okay. Well, then first of all, I did find an article. So if anybody wants to stay, all we do is lefty pointy head thingamajiggers. I have an article from a right-leaning source of all sides. It's their own little personal commentary about Mr. Speaker of the House being vacated. And, I wrote down a bunch of questions. How many times in the past has this ever happened? You have been here since the first Congress was ever voted in. How many times has a speaker ever been removed?
I think I remember back in the early 1800s, there was an attempt, but I don't think it's ever succeeded before.
I see. All right. Now, we also recently voted in the first non-Caucasian president. So that would be significant. Is this significant, or should have just happened at some point in time? This just happened to be the first one.
Well, it is very significant because it happened with such a low threshold to trigger the process, but it was a concession that the speaker made, or he was not speaker at the time, but candidate McCarthy made to become speaker, that they would lower the threshold of how many members it took to move to vacate the speaker's chair. And he agreed to it, and he challenged a couple of times saying, if you got something to file, bring it on. And they did.
Why would he do that? I moved a question around. So why would he make that deal to do this?
He wouldn't have become speaker otherwise. They would have gone on from 15 ballots to 30 to 40 to 50. And there's no way that caucus is so fractured with a slim majority of 5 seats. If you flip 5 seats, you no longer have a Republican majority. And it's such a difficult caucus to manage because of the extreme views that they're represented in what's a fairly extreme caucus to begin with, but there are some moderates in the caucus. And you can see that in the vote. I mean, all but 7 or 8 voted to retain him as speaker.
And to the thing of the 15 ballots, how many is normal to elect a speaker?
One.
So one and done. We nominate so-and-so to be Speaker of the House, and we're done, and we can move on with the business.
Well, typically each party puts forth a candidate, but the majority party is not going to vote for a candidate of the other party. So therefore, when Pelosi or whoever, Gingrich, had the majority, they put forth one candidate. You kind of go out and work behind the scenes trying to rally the troops and find out if you could get the votes. And sometimes it takes a while to do that, but normally when you get to the vote, they coalesce around a candidate. Some sort of consensus has emerged, and you have one ballot, and you're done. But this time, we had 15 ballots, and it took a while, and McCarthy made concessions, and those concessions came back to bite him in the butt.
So on that then, what was the cause? Why did they kick him out?
Well, Representative Gaetz, and that's spelled G-A-E-T-Z, I think, from Florida.
Yep.
He decided that McCarthy had committed a sin by putting forth what's called a continuing resolution to prevent the government from shutting down at the end of September. And every Republican proposal and the House failed because it didn't have enough spending cuts to satisfy Gates and those in the extreme wing of the party. And so McCarthy, recognizing that there's a little benefit to be gained from shutting down the government, he decided to take Leader McConnell's advice in the Senate and put forth a proposal that would garner some Democratic support. And he finally did in the closing moments Saturday and put forth a proposal, and it passed. But it was not what that extreme faction of the party wanted because it didn't contain the spending cuts they're looking for. So therefore, he forfeited his speakership.
Is this at all similar? I can't remember which state it was, but in the southeast somewhere, Tennessee or Kentucky, there were three, I guess they were state-level reps, and they were booted. Is this at all similar?
It's hard to see a lot of similarity. That was in Tennessee. Those representatives, those members of the legislature broke rules of decorum, and the membership voted to kick them out. This member, this speaker, who's also a member, didn't break any rules of decorum. He broke the cardinal promise that he was going to be a diehard, staunch conservative. And it's not a same thing at all. Those people broke the rules of the House or the Senate. I forget which they were, but they were members of the legislative body in Tennessee, and they broke the rules. And they were kicked out. And they were readmitted because the county commissions of those counties reappointed them for the vacancies.
Have you heard it floated that they would nominate Trump to be the Speaker of the House?
I have, and I don't imagine he would have any interest in it, and he certainly doesn't have the temperament to do that job, but I don't know how he could campaign for president and be trying to run the House of Representatives. It's a fairly significant job. It really is.
This is the third in line to the presidency. I mean, if the president gets nuked, you have the vice president and the Speaker of the House is the next in line.
Yes, wouldn't that be funny?
That would be amazing.
So,
but I don't want to drag this on for very long. They just, like last weekend, I guess it was like Friday, they closed the deal of to have just a 1 month extension on this whole budget thing. And now he gets booted. What is going to happen in a month or so at the end of November with them trying to, like, they can't conduct business if there is no speaker. So that would just be, it just keeps getting kicked down the road until they get one. But once they do get one, they still have to negotiate some sort of spending deal.
Well, first of all, what you said is not true. They have an acting speaker right now that's been dead.
Oh, that's right. They do. They have a pro tem one, right?
Yes. So the House's businesses will continue to take place. The risk is that the Democrats made a miscalculation, in my opinion. Time will tell if I'm right or if I'm wrong. But I think that what we learned in this was that McCarthy was not willing to let the country burn. Shutting down government is a painful experience. It really is. Now, most people listening feel differently. They think the government could shut down and nobody would think about it. But that's just not true. Every part of your daily life, from getting on an airplane to food safety inspection, to keeping the prisoners confined that should be confined, to prosecuting criminals, all these things require federal salaries to be paid. Parks and recreation sites, perhaps you could not miss those, but shutting down the government is particularly painful. And we just can't cut ourselves out of the situation we're in right now. We have expenditures that are greater than the recurring revenue streams. And we need to figure out how to do a combination of finding new revenues and curtailing the growth of spending. You really can't dramatically slash spending because about 3/4 of what we spend is already in statute, having to be spent by law. But what's going to happen, and my fear is that when this 45-day extension expires, we're in mid-November, which is coming up on a holiday season. And if the candidate who emerges to be speaker has learned anything, he will have learned that if you cut a deal with the Democrats, this is going to be the end of your speakership, which means he's going to be very hard-nosed about any type of deal with the Democrats. And means that there won't be a spending agreement and there'll be a government shutdown coming up on the holidays. Now, that's going to be a lot of pressure and it's going to depend on messaging. And the Democrats have shown themselves to be totally inept in this administration to message, as far as my opinion. And whoever is more clever at pointing the blame at the other and succeeding in convincing folks that we're not responsible for government, you'll hear the Republicans saying that it's the Biden shutdown. And you'll hear Biden saying it's the Republican shutdown. And it'll be just like it was in 95 when we had a long shutdown under Newt Gingrich. Clinton actually won that battle because he messaged better. This president messages horribly.
Wasn't there a shutdown in 12 or so?
Yes, there's been a number of them. There was one during the Trump administration over Christmas a few years back. It was actually the longest one on record occurred under Trump, I think.
But you said during Christmas, probably people they're already taking vacations and don't give a poop what goes on at Christmas anyway, and they went back to work shortly thereafter?
Yeah, but what about the paychecks, people who are not being paid? What I would do if I'm the Republicans, and I got to think they're at least as smart as I am. What I would do...
That's not necessarily true, though.
As I would parade all these people that are being ordered to work because you're told that it's your job. You've got to be in those control towers, and we'll pay you later. Yeah. I would get these people in front of a camera, and I would get them to boohoo about how difficult it is to pay bills and mortgage, and because of the intransigence of the Democrat Party, that I don't have a paycheck and I can't buy gifts for my family. If I can think of that, I'm confident they can think of that as well.
I have a person in chat saying that the federal workers did care during that shutdown. I think the last question I have for you is, why should PFRs care?
Well, you shouldn't obsess over it, but anytime there's a disruption of government operations, I suspect some PFRs are applying for, maybe, benefits in the process of going to an administrative law judge hearing for some sort of disability benefit. There's
sure.
things going on that the government does that impacts your life, and you should care, because when you need these services that you take for granted because they magically occur, that's when you should think about it, because services are going to be disrupted.
All right. Well, that was significantly enough time to talk about politics in that regard. Let us move over to an article from The Columbian. And it is to follow up on last week's episode. We discussed a proposal that would have removed community notification from Washington State's PFR registry. Now, I have a portion to play from last week's, where we were discussing. And you offered an opinion at the end. And it appears, though, Larry, that you have put on your little clairvoyant hat. You've been listening to Art Bell or something like that, and you were able to predict the future. And, I mean, I should cue the laugh track. Do you think this will become law?
I really don't. The law enforcement and victim advocacy organizations will put forth an intense campaign of opposition. And they will do this with intent on scaring the public.
This comes on the heels of that proposal in King County, Washington. A state advisory panel is doing damage control after recommendations regarding PFRs stirred outrage in the community. The recommendations are for community notifications to be eliminated when convicted PFRs are released from prison and returned to society. However, the chair of the Washington State PFR Board, SOPB, said this is all a misunderstanding that stems from research by an outside agency being included in a recent agenda packet.
Yeah, it was a mistake, all right. The article also states, quoting Brad Mayhew, who I think is the chair of the SOPB, said the research was outlined in a document that summarizes a portion of the model penal code, which is known as MPC, which was drafted by a separate agency. Mary Hugh said there are no plans to push it forward as a course of action for the Washington State Legislature to consider. So basically, Chairman Mary Hugh of the SOPB has decided this is not even going to be put forward as a proposal.
I do have to correct something. I had the wrong article pulled up on the screen. It is not from The Columbian. This is Como, K-O-M-O News. Just to make that clarification. So what happened next, though? I thought Washington was a bunch of liberal lefties. Your people.
Well, parts of the state are, but the liberal lefties have little sympathy for PFRs. In fact, Mary Hugh said, the confusion here is that included the materials we distributed for that meeting was a comprehensive model penal code that talks about a variety of different proposals that have been made to state legislatures for adoption. We're tasked with staying up to date on the latest research and policy proposals on PFR offender management.
So it wasn't the actual SOPB, it was the model penal code that has found that community notification actually undermines public safety. It also recommends that PFR registry should be reserved for law enforcement and not be made available to the public. The reasoning is that the attention notifications and registries can make it more difficult for offenders to get housing and jobs and successfully reintegrate into the community. Do you think it can pass now?
Not likely. First, the board does not even plan to recommend the proposal. Second, as Mary Hugh stated, there's a great deal of support for community notification on our board, and I would be shocked if any proposals to limit in any way or diminish that were successful. It cannot pass the legislative process.
This isn't, I remember seeing like on the NARSAL affiliates list, like, is this the, I don't remember the right words, but the somebody organization presents they're a panel and like a think tank of what the policy should be. I don't remember what this is called.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about, and I have scorned that because in my 30 years of legislative experience, I have never seen anybody say in our legislation, oh, well, they recommended that. We better pass it. I mean, it's not a big talking point here.
So is that just like wasted paper?
Yes, yeah, the American Law Institute you're thinking about, ALI.
Okay. Yeah. And so them having all the big brain social scientists, legal brain people, like this means nothing to policy?
No, because you're dealing with the public's emotions. And as this did exactly what I thought it was going to do, it caused a backlash among the public. And that's a sure way to end your political career if you go against the public on something as sensitive as this, and they're not likely to do it.
Mr. Doom and Gloom, that's why I leave that picture up there of you, Larry, and I don't change it around anymore because you were just Mr. Doom and Gloom. Let us go over to actually what is the Columbian. My apologies on jumping the gun on which article it was. But we had the right information going. I just told you the wrong article. This one is from the Columbian, and it says, a Portland man was acquitted last month after being granted a new trial on appeal nearly 5 years after he was convicted in connection with an undercover child sex sting. A Clark County Superior Court jury September 8th acquitted Jace Hambrick, 27, of attempted second-degree rape of a child and communicating with a minor for immoral purposes. And this is great news. I'm perfectly good friends with the boy's father. And as I recall, you were kind of down on the whole idea about him winning a trial anyway.
I was, because juries generally do not care. Jace was one of the several people arrested in the February 2017 after responding to an advertisement posted by an interagency task force posing as minors online. In Hambrick's case, he responded to a Vancouver detective's post in the casual encounters category of Craigslist about a girl looking for someone to talk to about video games. Initially, that's what the conversation centered on, but it drifted to something else.
The court records show the detective messaging Hambrick said multiple times that they were, how old, Larry? 13. And then after the conversation turned into a sexual, I'll read that all over again. The detective messaging Hambrick said multiple times that they were a 13-year-old girl before and after the conversation turned into a sexual nature. Hambrick, then 20, expressed doubt that a 13-year-old would be posting on Craigslist, and at one point he said he thought the fictitious girl was joking about her age. Now, can you admit that this turns out to be entrapment?
Yes, I can admit it, but the problem is it's for the fact finder, either the jury or the judge. But when Hambrick arrived at a Vancouver apartment to meet the girl, detectives arrested him, according to a probable cause affidavit. And I have not wavered in my opinion at all that people should disengage when a person morphs into a minor. It doesn't make any difference what you think. Disengage. You're not going to be as lucky as Jace was, and you're not going to have a determined parent and a lot of money to throw at this. It's easier to just disengage.
On May 21st, 2018, Hambrick's bench trial began in Clark County. The following day, Judge Gregory Gonzalez found Hambrick guilty on both accounts, court records show. Despite his convictions, Hambrick maintained his innocence. His defense attorney at the time filed multiple motions, including asking the judge to reconsider his verdict and to vacate the convictions. All of the motions were denied, according to court records. In November 2018, the judge sentenced Hambrick to 18 months in prison, which was an exceptionally low sentence. He was also ordered to register. The court records also show.
Yes, and Hambrick appealed on the basis of insufficient evidence and that his right to a jury trial was violated because he didn't personally sign the waiver. I actually agree with that. That's a significant thing. And I would never think of waiving jury trial without the client's signature, because that's going to come back and bite you as an attorney. But anyway, that's apparently what happened. His case was featured in August 2020 by the New York Times magazine that explored online predator stings in Washington. 2 years after he was sentenced, the Washington Court of Appeals issued an opinion that Hambrick's right to a jury trial was violated by his lack of signature, and the court vacated his convictions. By then, of course, he'd already served his sentence. The appeals court, however, did not find that there was insufficient evidence for his convictions. His case was set for a new trial, which began in front of a jury this time on September 5th, according to the court records.
At the new trial, Hambrick's defense attorney, Charles Lane, raised several issues with the investigation. He said Craigslist requires users to affirm that they are at least 18 years old, so Hambrick assumed he was talking to an adult. At one point in the conversation, Hambrick asked the fictitious girl to send him a photo. The photo he received was of a 24-year-old woman who turned out to be a Vancouver police officer, Lane said. That officer also answered the door when Hambrick arrived at the apartment, court records show. What more do you need to find that this is entrapment?
Well, as I said, I don't need any more. I think it is. But again, we have to convince juries and judges. But in the police interview after being arrested, Hambrick told officers, quote, if he arrived to find the person he was messaging was actually a 13-year-old, he would have left. And he said he had no intention of having sex with a minor. Most juries do not believe such proclamations by an accused. That's very self-serving. He was a compelling witness, obviously, and a juror was open-minded. It is very important that Hambrick also had no criminal history, and law enforcement search of his phone did not turn up any evidence of sexual misconduct with minors. All those things weighed in his favor, and those are things that you would certainly take into account before putting a person on trial. Nevertheless, he was still sentenced to prison in what was referred to as a very light sentence. And again, that would not have been the outcome here in New Mexico for a first-time offender. It just wouldn't have been. He would have gotten a probated sentence here.
So in your experience, why are you so afraid to go to trial on these kinds of cases?
Because mainly my grand jury experience of 3 months of listening to people and arguing with fellow jurors, and just not making any headway. Every sex case, they were ready to rubber stamp the indictments. And also, it's worth noting that one juror named Rick Smoody said the majority of the jury was in favor of convicting Hambrick when it first began deliberations. But as the jurors continued to discuss the case, they found enough reasons to cast doubt that Hambrick was actually seeking a minor. The juror said the evidence showed Hambrick was cooperative, perhaps to a fault. And he said Hambrick let law enforcement search his things, and he answered all their questions. And now I have to backtrack on something, because I always say, don't talk to the police. But I've never been put in this position in my career of having your cooperation with the police weighing favorably before a jury. So now I have to rethink that. But I would normally say to tell the police to take it and shove it. And this, as far as the jury is concerned, worked to his advantage.
I'm still troubled, Larry, that even if the person said they were 13 and he goes to the house and it is an adult, where does this fictitious minor come into the picture?
Well, obviously, they're not going to have a minor there and risk that you would take possession of a minor. I mean, the whole thing is a scam. But I think it's really important to say this jury was ready to convict him. At the beginning of the
without a doubt.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not a slam dunk by any means.
Right. And I also saw that he also stated when the jury was shown the photos the detective sent Hambrick, Smoody agreed the woman did not look like a minor. He said Hambrick never wavered and that he thought the person in the photo was a real adult. It was entirely credible that he was checking it out because she might have been for real, Smoody said. And in fact, There she was. She stood in front of him and opened the door. All 20-something and all that woman.
Yep. And again, that was an amazing open-minded jury. The grand jurors I served with would not have cared about the fact that it was a picture of an adult. They would have said, well, that was just, he was, they would have made every excuse in the world to justify convicting him. But he happened to have an open-minded jury in his determination, so he doesn't have a PFR conviction, and it's just fantastic. But Juror Smoody also said he finds this type of online sting, like in Hamburg's case, to be wrong. He said he believed law enforcement was casting too wide of a net, and that's an extremely insightful thing from a jury.
Can we get him on the podcast?
I don't know how we would find him, but if Kathleen knows how, yes.
Well, Smoody? Like, how many people can have that name?
Probably about 10 million.
Oh, God. Seriously? No. Lane, the defense attorney, said that when the sting operations first began, defense attorneys and prosecutors alike didn't like much about how they were operated or funded. At the time of Hamburg's case, investigators did not do enough to ensure the suspects were actually intending to meet minors, he said. Since then, agencies have made changes to how they conduct the stings, he said. Aha! So they've gone back and taken note of what they did wrong, and they probably improved things, Larry.
Well, yes, but we need to, as the people who actually instruct law enforcement and give them the powers that they operate, we actually need to make it clear that they must prove that there's an intent to have sex with a minor, and we need to clarify the statutory schemes. But anyway, he said, while Lane said Hambert's case isn't an outlier, he said it's unusual that he was acquitted. And I want to reiterate that. Yes, this is a great outcome. Congratulations to Kathleen and Jace, but don't figure this is going to become the norm.
Is there any avenue that all of the other people that are involved in Kathleen's group called CAGE, C-A-G, which is Citizens Against Government Entrapment, if I'm not mistaken on that one, is there an avenue that this is used as some kind of evidence, persuasive authority, all those terms, whichever one would work, to help those people out?
Very little, because A, this is a trial-level court. It went up on appeal and it got reversed on one issue alone, not insufficient evidence, but the fact of the waiver. So you'd have to find how many people had waived their right to a jury unknowingly without signing it themselves. And you would have a subgroup that could possibly reopen their old convictions and go back and roll the dice and go before a jury. If they've served all their time, perhaps they have nothing to risk, because maybe Washington law would prevent them from imposing a harsher sentence than what was originally impose, but this won't have much impact beyond this case. And if it is, it will be for people who had waived their jury right unknowingly.
So only because of that, he was able to go back before the jury. And I guess, so it's, please answer that one before I answer the next one.
Yes, that was what got him back to the courthouse again, was the attorney waived jury. Like I say, I would never have done that.
Right, because he had served his sentence at that point. So he was like, quote unquote, done. He still had the registry to contend with, but he was done. Why would you then go, quote unquote, get another bite of the apple? That's the expression you always use.
Well, because the higher court said so. Because he did not knowingly waive his right to a jury trial.
Yeah, right.
But I'm saying I would never have, I can't imagine any attorney I've worked with in case preparation where we would waive a jury trial without getting a signed waiver from the defendant. I can't fathom that happening.
Sure. I remember I've talked about this before, that when I was being sentenced and I'm sitting there in the courtroom with the attorney on the other side of the glass, and the whole room is just super loud and booming, you can't hear anything. And somewhere on there, I signed that I was waiving right to a trial and all that stuff. I mean, I remember, of all the other things that I was signing at that time, but I remember that happening.
Well, that's a standard part of the waiver when you're doing a plea. But he would have went to trial, but he waived his right to a trial by jury.
Yeah.
And that's an unconscionable thing for a defense attorney to do that.
Right. Is there any sort of punishment, whatever the right word would be, is there any sort of punishment for that attorney that did that?
Not likely. He's going to tell a different story. If their complaint made, he's going to say, I discussed it very thoroughly with my client. He was young and impressionable, and I thought he signed the paper. I don't have it now, but I'm almost certain he signed the paper. That's what he's going to say.
Well, I do have Kathleen scheduled at the end of the month. Schedules just could never work out with the time that we took off and whatnot, and then she was busy. But she's supposed to come on, so we can talk to her firsthand towards the end of the month, if I'm not mistaken, the 28th. I don't know if that's the right day of the week. Yeah, the 28th, I'm pretty sure is what it's going to be.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
All right, let us go to this article over from Axol, which is the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws. Is that right?
That sounds familiar.
Very good. All right. Axol has filed a federal lawsuit in Missouri. Missouri? Which way do you say it? Missouri or Missouri?
Missouri.
The case is Thomas I. Sanderson versus Andrew Bailey in his official capacity as Attorney General of the state of Missouri. And James Houdanik? Oh my God, what is up with these names you keep coming up with every week? Houdanik? Which one do you think it is?
I think it's Houdanik.
Houdanik. So this is James Houdanik in his official capacity as Chief of Police of the city of Hazelwood, Missouri. And what is this going to be about?
This action challenges the constitutionality of a provision of Missouri state law mandating that persons convicted of sexual offenses display a sign at their residence declaring, quote, no candy or treats at this residence each Halloween. This is prohibited by Missouri Revised Statute 589.426.1.3.
And what are they trying to do? What are they seeking?
Two things. First, the defendants, they're asking the defendants be enjoined in perpetuity from enforcing the Halloween sign posting mandate, and that the Halloween sign posting mandate codified in the statute section I just read be declared null and void under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
Courts in other jurisdictions have struck down similar Halloween sign posting mandates on the grounds that they are a classic example of compelled speech. Do you think that this case is a good one? Do you like it?
I do, and it's very solid. Courts have indeed struck down similar requirements, and it's noteworthy that the only circuit precedent that they cited in this complaint is McClendon versus Long, and that's 22 Federal 4th at 1330, and that's from the 11th.
I know that one.
In 2022, I was going to ask you if you remember that. That was the case that I, as your host, planned and worked diligently with the attorney in Georgia to see that we prevailed, and we did prevail.
The complaint states, further, sign posting mandates such as that imposed by the state of Missouri pose a danger to PFRs, their families, and their property. That is because the signposting mandate and its association with the requirement to register is highly publicized by the state and local governments, as well as the media. Further, both the government and the media encourage the public to view the occupants of any house displaying that sign as at issue as likely abusers of chirins. Do you agree with that?
I do indeed. This is placing a target on the registrant as well as all occupants of that dwelling.
The complaint states, there is no empirical evidence that the state of Missouri's continued assertion of a danger to children from registrants on Halloween or for any special regulation of registrants on Halloween. In fact, the leading association of specialists in the treatment of PFRs, the Association for Treatment of Sexual Abusers, ATSA, affirmatively denounces Halloween restrictions such as Missouri's. I know you say that evidence is not necessarily required. What about in this case that involves the First Amendment? What is it about this case that involves the First Amendment?
Well, that does change the equation. Normally, you're looking at what's called a rational basis review, but this changes the legal standard dramatically. in First Amendment challenges, there's a much higher threshold for the government to overcome. They could, in fact, require signs for a very limited number of registrants. But those registrants would have to receive some due process that identifies them as likely to lure a child. Otherwise, they just cannot impose this blanket requirement. So listen to me, law enforcement. If you want to do these things, and I don't think they're solid, but if you want to do it from constitutional, from not being challenged, you have to have due process. Remember, due process. And you have—
What does this word mean?
And you have to target those people who have, in their offense behavior and their criminality, that they have done something like luring a child. And if you were to narrow it down, then you would take the 800,000 PFRs nationwide and you'd have a category of 17. Because the number of adults who have actually lured a child to some sort of private place and sodomized and done ugly things to them is probably very, very small. But you could do this type of thing to that offender with due process to show that they have this propensity and it has been untreated and unmanaged. But you can't do it as a blanket policy. So folks, listen, if you want to do these things, tell your state legislators that we want to do this, but it's going to cost us some money because we want to do it in a constitutional way. Remember, you put your hand on the Bible and you said you're going to enforce and defend the Constitution. That means all aspects of the Constitution.
I mean, so I was just going to bring up, when I joined the military and re-enlisted and all that stuff, I had to swear to uphold the Constitution against foreign enemies, both foreign and domestic. That would be including due process, correct?
It would. And these people, when they get elected to office, they pay a lot of lip service to the Constitution. But what they actually mean, let me interpret it to you. They mean, I will enforce the Constitution on things that have big money behind them, like the NRA, and things where they can be an immense amount of political pressure brought to bear if I don't. So you'll find a lot of sheriffs that magically believe in strong defense of the Second Amendment because they know the consequences of not having that position. But when it comes to something about PFRs and due process, they magically go silent and they forget all about that same Constitution.
And DAs obviously are there to uphold the law, and this is not, well, this is law for them, right?
It is, in fact, law.
In Butts, it wasn't with Gary Long. That wasn't law. That was him making up something. That's why it was, I'll say, easy to win in court.
It was easier because he could not cite to the law. This is not going to save Missouri. But it is easier for them to defend it. Well, I mean, we put our hand on the Bible, so we're going to enforce the law. If you don't like the law, change it.
Yeah. But, and to the thing, another thing that you say is, signing a law, you assume it's constitutional until somebody brings a challenge for it.
That's generally true. In First Amendment cases, when you're restricting the content of speech, which arguably I would say this is restricting the content, you're not telling them particular words that they can say, but you're telling them particular things that they can't do to express themselves on Halloween. And yeah, you're telling them that they can't communicate with people who might come to their door. So I would say this is very close to a content-based restriction. And this is the highest standard of scrutiny applied, strict scrutiny. And I just don't think they can overcome it.
Would you let me read part of the statute? Is that cool?
Yes.
Missouri revised statute section 589.426 and the Halloween signposting mandate. Effective August 28, 2008, the statute provides in full, so hold on to your seats, kids, as follows. Any person required to register as a PFR under the sections I just said above shall be required on October 31st of each year to avoid all Halloween-related contact with chirons, remain inside his or her residence between the hours of 5 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. unless required to be elsewhere for just cause, including but not limited to employment or medical emergencies. Post a sign at his or her residence stating no candy or treats at this residence and leave all outside residential lighting off during the evening hours after 5 p.m. Any person required to register as a PFR under sections 589-400 to blah, 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 who violates the provision of subsection 1 of this section shall be guilty of a Class A misdemeanor Now, has the plaintiff in this been prosecuted for a violation?
According to the complaint, he has. Plaintiff Sanderson and his family moved to the city of Hazelwood in or about the year 2000. Each Halloween for 22 years, for a 22-year period between 2000 and 2022, Sanderson's family erected and maintained lavish Halloween displays at their home and on their property. The Sanderson's display has been a neighborhood tradition for many years, with over 300 people visiting each Halloween. In or about October 2012, Hazelwood police officers appeared at Sanderson's residence to inquire about the Halloween and alleging that he might be in violation. Subsequently, they concluded that he was not, for whatever the reasons were. It wasn't clear in the complaint, but they told him that he was good to go.
I mean, man, it says, I guess it doesn't really say you can't do it. Like, I just read avoid all Halloween contact with chivins, remain inside, posting a sign, and leave residential lighting outside. Now, if you've got lights on in your yard, Larry, lighting up your skeletons, that's not residential lighting.
Good point.
All right, it goes on to say that on or about October 31st, 2022, while his residence was decorated as it has been for the past 22 Halloweens, six marked vehicles from the Hazelwood Police Department descended upon Sanderson residence with sirens blaring. At least 10 Hazelwood police officers then entered Plaintiff Sanderson's property from all sides, including through his neighbor's yard. Officers told Plaintiff Sanderson that he was in violation of the statute that he had twice before been told did not apply to him. The officers asked for permission to search his property, which Plaintiff Sanderson refused to grant permission, requesting instead that the officers obtain a warrant. Do you approve of him telling them to go get a warrant?
I do, indeed. But did you hear how many officers they had descending on his property for a misdemeanor? Now, can you please admit that that's funny?
This is, okay, funny in the sense of, oh my God, the guy just has some skeletons and boo, boo, boo on his front yard and they need six cop cars? How many, and they're loaded probably four deep in each car?
In our studio audience, someone Googled this Hazelwood, Missouri. Let's see what the size of the town is and what type of police force we're talking about. But I'm betting this is like a third of the police force.
Yes, it probably is. Hazelwood, Missouri population. All right. So no, it is not funny, Larry. And then on November 3rd, 2022, law enforcement obtained a warrant and arrested Plaintiff Sanderson and placed him in custody. Plaintiff Sanderson was then charged with one misdemeanor count of violating the statute. The St. Louis County Court convicted Plaintiff Sanderson of violating the statute and sentenced him to 12 months of unsupervised probation. Plaintiff is currently on probation and will remain so through April 12th of 2024. Now, what do you think of this plaintiff?
I like this plaintiff. He's about as good as you could hope for, unlike the case we discussed last week when we had the worst possible challenge ever located.
This town has 25,000 people.
Yeah, so they had like a third of the police force out there at his residence.
Before we go out of here and cover the last little section, what do you think the odds of success are?
Oh, in this one, they're excellent. I have wanted to do this challenge. Our bureaucracy at the organization I serve on the board of has been moving a little bit slowly than I would like. And another organization got to it first, but this is something I wanted to go at for about a year now.
Doesn't Janice have experience in this? They filed something similar in California years ago?
Yes, they do.
So is this something that you can kind of rubber stamp and just fill in the form letter and go about the challenge?
Yes. You look at her complaint and it's very similar to what we used in Georgia. And it would be similarly what we use around the country. I want to do all these. I know it doesn't bring down the registry. It's not the big one, but it conveys to law enforcement and to the policymakers and lawmakers that there are limits to what will be tolerated. And it puts boundaries around what's acceptable. And being told that you cannot decorate, you cannot engage in your basic rights as an American is unacceptable. And we're going to shoot you down on that.
I'm struggling to really grasp, Larry, that the people continue to be elected and reelected and they have to swear an oath to the Constitution that they're going to uphold it and all this stuff. But in that, so fine, you have a statute that says to do the thing, to uphold the law. But you also then have the First Amendment right. Now, maybe those aren't exactly covered the same way of the First Amendment being about freedom of speech, freedom of religion. But when I first started becoming involved with NARSL and something along those lines was something along the Halloween sign was going on, and I heard someone said, it's also the right to be able to express yourself, which I didn't really, or I guess it was the right to be able to hear a message. And then you brought up that this is your ability to express yourself.
Correct.
That these would be perfectly good challenges to go after.
Absolutely. And we need to be doing, we as advocates need to be doing more of these challenges. We're not going to bring the registry down through judicial intervention. I'm sorry to break that news to you. But we can contain the monster, and we need to go after everything that we can to contain this monster. Litigation will eventually wear these people down. But these people in the legislative bodies, they're part-time, they're homemakers, they're different. They don't know, they're not constitutional lawyers. They're being told by the Attorney General and experts that testify that these are constitutional, and they don't know any better.
So we shouldn't blame them?
Not per se. We should not blame the legislative bodies because they're being told by people they trust that these are good laws and that they're very much constitutional.
Do you think it's lost on them of it's not just about the PFR in the House, but also potentially the other innocent people that are in the House, their parents, kids, spouses, whatever, that can be impacted by this public awareness to them? Does that ever enter anybody's consciousness?
No, because the PFR population seldom shows up and brings their minors and explains that to them. Hey, I'm afraid because of this, and I'm bullied because of that. They don't use the boohoo technique that the victims advocates do. They bring in the boohooers to cry. And I'm sorry, but boohooing is very effective. We need to get into the boohoo business.
we're gonna run a boohoo campaign, Larry. All right. I think this is a finally. No, I don't think it's a finally. We have something. Oh, I have to even like change screens because I could not get this article to load, Larry, without using my special sneaky techniques. Where do I go for this one? What did I do?
It was the Washington Post.
I know, but I could not get it to load on Chrome, so I had to go do something sneaky to make it load. There. Now it'll load. Okay. Now we can look at it. And this article is from the Washington Post about the blackmail of teenage boys. And you know, Larry, I have a 16-year-old myself, so this is something that hits kind of close to home. The article was from the Washington Post, as I said, written by Chris Moody and published October 2nd, 2023. And it states, Lynn and Paul were sitting in their Seattle home one night earlier this year when their son, Michael, a 17-year-old high school football player, burst into the room and made a beeline for his mom's purse in the dining room table. Paul asked, hey, what are you up to there? Their son paused, took a breath, and leaned against the wall. I'm being blackmailed, he said. He had been chatting with a person through Instagram and Snapchat who purported to be a 16-year-old girl. She saw his profile and told him he was cute. Michael had never met the person, but the account was filled with photos and details about the girl's life that made it appear real. The two flirted back and forth. The person behind the account asked to see a photo of him in the nude and specifically requested he include his face. Alone in the room that night, Michael dashed off a picture he took with his phone. Suddenly, the person who had seemed so sweet and fun while chatting for weeks demanded Michael send hundreds of dollars through Zelle. If Michael refused, the person threatened they would send the nude photo to his family and friends. He tried to set up a Zelle account on his phone, but it required his social security number. That's why he was digging in his mom's purse. He was hoping she might have his card there.
I didn't catch that part. I totally went through that. But according to the article, Michael had fallen prey to what online safety and law enforcement experts call financial sextortion, in which predators befriend victims online under false pretenses, entice them to send incriminating photos, and then demand payment under threat that they will expose the photos to family and friends. The number of sextortion cases targeting young people has exploded in the past couple of years, with teen boys being the specific targets, said Lauren Coffran, executive director of Exploited Children Division of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They're using shame, embarrassment, and fear, and they're tapping into that. They're exploiting children's worst nightmares. This is gross stuff.
The repercussions of the abuse are devastating. At least a dozen boys died by suicide in 2022 after they were blackmailed, according to the FBI. Michael's parents were surprised he would find himself in this position, but immediately helped him navigate the next step.
Well, what do you do if your teen is a victim of sextortion? I don't have a teen. I mean, I did about 160 years ago, but what do you do?
According to the article, if you're in this situation, experts advise you to immediately stop responding and block the harasser. Do not delete the conversation so you have proof and you can report it to authorities. Do not send any money, even if the user has sent incriminating photos. Giving in to demands will rarely make them go away and will often encourage them to demand more. Next, alert the platform. Most have a place to report sextortion. I have problems with that advice, Larry, but what do you think? What do you agree with that advice?
Not entirely. Do you remember a recent episode where a father called the police?
I do.
The police threatened to prosecute the minor girl. It was a girl in that case. And I know of only one state that protects minors from prosecution for making photos of their private parts, and that's New Mexico. I do not know of any other state, so calling the police might have some risk attached to it.
Can you see any legal way to insulate yourself? Like, I guess don't talk to the police. Call an attorney first and then talk to the police.
That might be the first step, but all I can say is that parents are going to have to speak to your adolescents and urge them not to send any selfies, particularly nude selfies, I should say. You can send all the selfies you want, but don't send nude selfies because these can bite you in the butt.
I got bad news that they could use all kinds of AI tools and make whatever you send them. Suppose you don't include your face, Larry, and then in another picture you do include your face with some creative photoshopping. You could put the two together and now you have a nude selfie.
But do not send any selfies of your junk.
I'm with you, but it wouldn't be very hard to even craft the other part of that, of making up somebody else's junk and putting the other person's face on it.
Well, but we would get into that in discovery. If you came to me as a defendant telling me that that's not your junk, well, I'm going to have to say, well, we're going to have to look at your junk and compare your junk to this junk and see if the junk is a match.
That's what they did with Michael Jackson.
That's exactly what we would have to do.
Now we're running around looking at minors' junks, Larry.
Well, we would have to do that because we would have to. Good grief. I'd have to tell the prosecutor, look, I need for you to consider dismissal in this case because the junk that's in that photo is not my client's junk. And if you want to verify that, we'll go into that. But we have a different junk, and I'm going to put my junk of my client's junk on for the jury, and we're going to get an acquittal at that point. Do you really want to go through this?
This is ridiculous. This is sad. All I can say to parents is that please speak to your childrens and urge them to not send selfies.
I totally agree.
Lastly, Larry, I hope we can do this one quick. This comes from Florida, and this is from News4Jax, J-A-X, that is. The article says, a number of new laws are now in effect as of Sunday. Arguably, the most controversial centers around changes to Florida's death penalty. Child rapists can now face execution for their crimes. The law specifically pertains to child victims under the age of 12. Higher courts have already said imposing death sentences in these types of cases is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. What say you?
Well, I say it's unconstitutional in my opinion, but Florida courts now have a green light to sentence certain offenders labeled as child rapists to death row. It was a measure that received bipartisan support as it rose through the Tallahassee legislative process. Upon signing it into law, Governor Ron DeSantis said, quote, these are really the worst of the worst. The perpetrators of these crimes are often serial offenders. You always want bipartisan support for legislation. Here's an example of something that's bipartisan and is not good. Bipartisan doesn't necessarily mean good.
Maria De Liberato is the executive director of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. She does not disagree. She said, of course, child sexual battery is one of the most horrific crimes that one can think of. De Liberato, an attorney herself, explains even though the law is now technically in effect in Florida, the Supreme Court would first have to reverse its initial ruling for it to apply to a particular case. Do you want me to read that one too, Larry?
Sure.
Okay. De Liberato also points to alarming statistics. According to the Child Welfare Information Gateway, about 90% of child sex abuse victims know their abuser, and about 30% of children are abused by family members. So now you've got this whole dynamic where a child is going to bear the weight of a possible death sentence to a neighbor, an uncle, grandfather, something that's that someone that they knew, they know that everybody in their family is not going to feel exactly the same way about. The end.
Now that's going to be sad, because when you have the whole family, I can assure you that I know Florida is strongly in favor of the death penalty, but there are going to be people in the family that may not live in Florida, may not be pro-death penalty. And so you're going to split families apart in terms of, I don't think the death penalty should be applied in a case like this. But hopefully the courts strike it down. But again, folks, bipartisanship doesn't necessarily mean good. It can be good, but it's not necessarily.
Hey, there was something that I just read, though, that says about 90% of victims. So 90%, that means some number, 10 or less, is of people that are unknown quantity. Like, they've just admitted that essentially the registry is watching the wrong people.
But how would you watch the right people if they haven't offended yet? How would you determine who to watch?
We wouldn't have a registry then, because it doesn't make much sense to watch the people that you don't need to be watching. Not necessarily don't need to be, but these other people are going to be the ones that are going to end up in court sooner.
So, well, we shouldn't be registering anybody if they've paid their debt to society, but that's a discussion for another podcast.
I agree with you. I looked for new patrons. There's no new patrons, but you know, feel free if you want to listen and subscribe for even $1 a month. That would make me a happy camper. But you have something to report about a new subscriber.
Yes, we actually have a free world subscriber named Scott that just signed up for a year. Can you believe that? A year.
Where is Scott located, give or take?
I think Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, eh? All right. Well, fantastic. Is there anything that you would like to talk about for the next 30 seconds before we close it out?
No, just let people make people aware that we are not going to record next week because you're traveling to the Bahamas, but you'll be back the following week.
Absolutely. It's going to be a long drive, too. All right. Well, make sure that you head over to registrymatters.co, where you can find the show notes, and subscribe to the podcast with your favorite podcast app there, or do it actually in your podcast app and search for it there. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And as I said before, subscribe over at patreon.com/registrymatters. Nothing else, Larry?
Nothing else.
Very good. I hope everybody has a great weekend. It's a holiday weekend for most people, or at least many people. It is, I don't even want to call it Columbus Day. It's an Indigenous Persons Day now, I think. Isn't that right?
That is what I recollect it being called.
Very good. And I hope everybody has a great week, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.